Well, yesterday the Federal Treasurer Scott Morrison kicked off again in a debate into housing affordability, arguing that the key to bringing down house prices is for the states to remove impediments to supply, including cutting red tape around planning issues. The Treasurer has flagged he'd be willing to offer the states incentive payments in return for increasing housing supply. That's an idea that's pleased the states, but Labor state treasurers also say the Commonwealth has to play a role, including reducing incentives for property investors like negative gearing and capital gains tax. This debate comes as Australia's household debt continues to soar. Debt now equal to 186% of net disposable income, and that's one of the highest levels of household debt in the world. Saul Eslake is an independent economist and a long-time watcher of the housing market. Saul Eslake, welcome back to Breakfast.
Thanks for having me, Frank.
Saul, we've long heard the argument that increasing housing supply is the key to improving housing affordability, and the federal government now seems willing to provide some incentives to the states to make that happen because, gee, I remember as far back as Peter Costello saying this is what needed to happen. Doing things like cutting red tape, releasing more land, building more infrastructure, incentives for that kind of action by the states, is that a good idea?
Yes, it is, and you're right to say that people who've been following the housing market closely for a long time have long pointed to blockages on the supply side as one of the reasons for deteriorating housing affordability and rising house prices. But most serious analysts of the housing market would also argue that action to dampen demand would also be helpful, particularly in allowing people to live where they want to live rather than necessarily where vacant land can be converted into new housing, typically on the outer fringes of Australia's major cities where some people do want to live but many don't.
I'll come back to action to dampen demand, but that notion of opening up land not being the answer, we heard that, especially in a city like Sydney, which has a big sprawl, so the open land, the land openings would be way, way away from the CBD where most of the jobs are in and around. That's one issue. And the other issue is that there's already a lot of infill of apartments going on, say, in a city like Sydney, massive building going on at the moment. And yet, as that supply comes online, it doesn't seem to be reducing the cost of these apartments. In fact, they're going up.
Well, that's right. I mean, it is interesting that people have said for many years that state and local government planning laws and land use policies have been a major inhibitor to increases in supply. Yet, although there haven't been many major changes to or reforms of those policies in recent years, nonetheless, we have seen an enormous increase in housing supply coming through, despite the absence of major changes on that side. I mean, only in the last financial year, we saw 226,000 new dwellings commenced across Australia, up from 144,000 5 years ago.
Yeah, that's massive. It is.
We saw over 200,000 new dwellings completed in 2015-16, and there are almost 210,000 new dwellings still under construction as of the end of the last financial year, and that's up from 127,000 5 years ago. So clearly, there is some capacity to increase housing supply, but as you also say, much of that has been in the form of apartments rather than detached dwellings, and one of the reasons why dwelling prices are still rising very rapidly is that, or may be, that the kind of housing that is now being built in large quantities isn't necessarily the kind of housing that people want to buy.
Is there a role there for the federal government? Because Scott Morrison, offering the states some incentives if they open supply, that's, a role he can find for the Commonwealth that he can articulate, particularly given he's ruled out changes to the tax breaks like negative gearing and capital gains tax incentives. So there's that role. But is there more the federal government could do here? And I'm not even going to population policy, which is obviously, I hear a lot of people listening will be going, there's too many people, that's the pressure. But, things like changing, some of the rules around to encourage people, older people, to leave their family homes, because we all know that there's a huge number of houses every night where, there's two bedrooms empty every night in this city.
Most of the factors that affect the supply of housing are solely within the purview of state and local governments, and there's not much the federal government can do to change those policies other than bribing the states to change them. And history suggests that that can be a very effective way of getting state and territory governments to do things that they ought to do but won't otherwise do. So I think what the Treasurer has proposed there is certainly worth pursuing. Other things that could be done in which the federal government might be able to play a useful role would be improving infrastructure connections, be they roads or public transport, between some of those areas where there is vacant land that currently takes hours to get from to where there are jobs. If governments could provide infrastructure that reduced that commuting time, that might make living in those places more attractive, and increasing the supply of housing in those areas part of the solution to the housing affordability problem. When it comes to encouraging people to consider shifting to housing that's more appropriate to their locations, part of the problem is stamp duty, and that, of course, is once again a state problem, and the federal government could perhaps consider bribing the states to reform their tax regimes if they thought that would actually make a difference.
Well, the Treasurer mentioned those. He said other solutions could include re-examining transaction tax, and as you say, stamp duty is a key tax involved in the transaction of buying and selling a house. You've supported a land tax, I believe, instead of a stamp duty in some cases?
Yes. I, like most economists, think a desirable reform would be to replace stamp duties with a more broadly based land tax from which owner-occupiers are not exempt, as they are from most state land tax regimes at the moment. And indeed, we sort of have a case study of that now in the ACT, where the ACT government is over a 20-year period phasing out stamp duties and replacing them not with land tax, but with municipal rates, which of course the ACT government can increase because they're in effect the de facto Canberra City Council. For a state government to emulate the same thing would require them to cross the politically difficult threshold of removing the current exemption for owner-occupied housing. But interestingly, the ACT election kind of suggests that that may not be as challenging politically as state treasurers of all political persuasions have previously assumed that it would be. I mean, this was an issue in the ACT election, and yet there was a swing to the government that is introducing this policy. So that's something that I think ought to be considered.
Saul, I do want to get on to household debt, but just briefly then, on this notion of stamp duty, it can be quite large on, you know, property house prices are going up and up and up. Is it a disincentive? Is it acting? Can we measure that?
Yes, I think it is acting as a disincentive. And in addition to that, of course, it makes state government revenues much more volatile and unpredictable, and sometimes leads to state governments getting into financial difficulties when the housing market turns down. So there's a lot of very good reasons for that. You need careful transitional provisions to make sure that people who've bought houses recently and paid stamp duty on them aren't subject to double taxation. But those kind of transitional arrangements can be devised in ways that will be fair to all parties.
Let's go to Australia's soaring household debt, because it is one of the highest in the world, the level. It's highest amongst the wealthiest 60% of the population here. Does that mean we don't need to worry too much that our debt levels are rising because the wealthy are less likely to struggle with paying off their debts?
It does mean that the level of household debt in Australia isn't necessarily as troubling as similar levels of household debt would be in, for example, the United States, where much more of it was owed by households in the bottom end of the income distribution. Another way of describing the situation is that there hasn't been as much imprudent lending by Australian banks and other lenders as there had been in the US in the years leading up to the financial crisis or in some other European economies. And the fact that debt servicing ratios are relatively low by Australian historical standards because interest rates are very low also means that the probability of a US or Irish or Spanish style implosion of household debt and house prices is, I think, a pretty remote possibility.
Okay.
But it does nonetheless make us vulnerable to external shocks, and as Glenn Stevens said in his last speech, reduces the effectiveness of lower interest rates in stimulating demand because people, even rich people, are less comfortable about taking on more debt given that they now have so much of it.
Saul Eslake, thank you very much for joining us.
Thanks for having me, friend.
Saul Eslake, he's an independent economist. You're listening to RM Breakfast. It's 14 minutes to 9.